with embarrassment and find myself striding down the corridor, out, away. It's an intensified version of the feeling I often get after a long day in the office. It's the need to be alone, secluded from every other human voice in the world. When I'm like this, I can't even read a book or listen to music. It's all-encompassing and it swallows my sanity into its depths. I listen again to my mother, refusing to let me create her a heaven, her raspy voice scratching at my heart. I hear Don's judgmental despair holding me back from a sense of achievement. They have always judged what I do. I have never been good enough. Is what I do benevolent? Is it humane? Once we just lived and we died, and now all these people are kneeling at my feet expecting more, expecting everything. I can see them. Yarrick, Claire, all the many, many clients I've had over the years. I stride out through the doors to the building, and I'm on the street, walking in a direction I never take. My trousers flap against the sensitive skin beneath my tattoo, catching on the scabs. The world around me blurs into a mindless meditation as I hear only the repeated fall of my feet on the pavement. I imagine the feathers of my angel's wings scabbing over and thickening into black, ugly scars that wind up my leg like earthworms looking for a place to burrow. The wind whips against my face, and my hair loosens itself. I let it fly across my face and catch in the wetness of my eyes, almost wishing I could miss an uneven point in the pavement and stumble, falling, stopping myself by a self-imposed kind of violence before I can do anything more stupid. And then, at the corner of the street, something does stop me. A vibration from my chip, a light flashing in my vision, and a calm voice speaking directly into my ear canal. "This is a drill," the woman says. "Please proceed immediately to your nearest place of shelter." She says it again while I'm still trying to process what's happening. Arrows appear in my vision, directing me back in the direction of the clinic. We have a safe room in the basement. Leela will be looking around, wondering where I am, nibbling at the skin around her fingernails. "This is a drill," the voice repeats. Would they tell us if it was the real thing? If drones were swarming in the skies at this moment, would they want us to scream and scatter? Or would they want us to walk calmly and quietly towards shelter? I'm frozen to the spot by something that isn't quite fear or vulnerability. It's a sudden attack of hopelessness that crawls over me. And then, before I can collapse in a heap, Yarrick is there, grabbing my hand and spinning me towards him. I'm briefly terrified.
"I'm sorry. I can't help it."
His words reach me slowly as if transmitted through water.
"I can't stop thinking about you."
For a second, I know that I could lose everything. But then he kisses me, and the thought falls silent as the pressure of his lips seems to burst my eardrums. My grip on my perfectly structured world slips and shatters. Chapter 10. We walk down the stairs to the basement of the clinic. It's only when I reach for the door handle that I realize we've been holding hands the whole way. My palm tingles from the cold of the metal and I glance back at him as we enter the room. His cheeks are flushed from the jog, or perhaps from the kiss. And as I turn my attention to those awaiting us, I feel as if our intimacy is written across our faces in blood.
"Izzy, there you are!"
I can see that Leela is forcing a wan smile through her worry. She doesn't hide her concerns as well as me.
Tea?
Yes, yes, please.
And for you, Mr. Woods?
Please.
I'm so sorry about this, she says as she turns to the machine. We still haven't decorated down here. It's on my list.
It's fine,
Yarrick bats away her apology.
It's homely. And we all laugh, because of course it's a joke.
A rather obvious one, but it breaks the awkward atmosphere.
Caleb is sitting on the only chair in the room, chatting to Harry, who's leaning against the wall, hands in pockets. Maya is sitting on the floor in the corner, stockinged legs out in front of her, chatting to an older couple who I think are Harry's clients. I try not to let my gaze rest on her for too long. We haven't spoken again since she followed me on my walk home, and I have no desire to continue the conversation. When I look away, I feel her eyes flick over me. The room isn't tiny. You could fit 5 times as many people in here, but it is uncomfortable. There's no natural light, just a glow coming from a pair of copper floor lamps standing in opposite corners, like boxers in a ring. The walls are bare grey plaster, and the old terracotta quarry tiles on the floor are cracked, unswept. I squint down at the area around my feet and realize with distaste that it's not just dusty but filthy. I feel my toes scrunch up inside my shoes. It smells dry and lifeless. It reminds me of my grandmother's disused garage where my best friend and I used to hide for hours at a time until our voices were hoarse from the dry, granular air. We've only had to assemble in here once before, and it didn't seem as bad then. I wonder how it can have got so dirty in the meantime. Leela thrusts mugs of tea towards Yarrick and me, and we both reach out at the same time. I feel his arm move against mine, and I have to swallow down the nerves that sizzle in my chest. Leela is looking at me. I blink and look away, but I can still feel her gaze on me, and I wonder how she could have any idea what's happened. Caleb stands up and offers his chair to Yarrick.
Do take a seat, Mr. Woods.
I watch Yarrick refuse the offer and take the chair over to the couple in the corner. He bends to place it down for the lady, and his body eclipses the lamp. A halo of light escapes around the fuzziness of his outline, softening the angles of his shoulders and the awkward jut of his hip. Caleb's eyes follow him, noting the rebuttal.
Seriously, I do apologize for the inconvenience,
Caleb continues in his most charming tones, casting his voice around the room now more loudly than is necessary given the space.
I'm sure we'll be out of here soon.
He pushes back his shoulders, slaps his hand against Yarrick's back, and I'm embarrassed for us all. He feels threatened by him in such close quarters, I imagine. A young, handsome client with enough money to hire me as his heaven architect. No, Caleb wouldn't like that at all. It wouldn't even cross his mind to throw the fact that Yarrick is dying into the equation.
It's not a problem,
Yarrick replies, sitting down with his back against the wall. He doesn't even dust the patch of floor first, and I fight the urge to move him, to wipe the floor with my hand and clean off his trousers. Bite at my thumbnail as I think about it. I realize he's looking at me and smiling in a way that I can't decipher. It could be amusement, but I feel as if he's just looked right inside my head and scanned my thoughts. I can't bring myself to smile back, but I dare to look longer into the green eyes of his. I should feel powerful standing over him, but I feel tiny. He raises the mug to his mouth and shakes his head as he looks away. I sip my tea and can feel Leela's eyes switching between us, her lips pursed. I close my eyes, but I imagine drones and bombers filling the skies over the office,
So I open them again and begin to pace back and forth on my side of the door. I think I see Caleb tense his jaw.
So, Yarrick, I hear that your sessions with Isabel are going well?
Leela asks. I glare at her, but all of a sudden she won't look at me.
Yarrick nods a few times and raises his eyebrows in what looks like approval.
For a moment, I think that's the only answer she's going to get. But then he opens his mouth.
She's amazing, he says. Even better than I expected her to be.
I feel blood swarm to my cheeks and I drop my chin to my chest.
It's quite claustrophobic in here, isn't it?
I say, running my fingertips down the edge of the closed door, counting the notches and imperfections in the woodwork.
It could be better,
says Harry, and I silently thank him for helping me to change the topic. In the corner, Maya and the couple continue to speak in hushed tones. The rest of us are quiet for a few moments.
This is the second drill this year, Harry continues. That can't be a good thing.
His arms are folded, and he's not speaking to any one of us in particular.
I guess they just want to make sure we're
safe, prepared, protected. I struggle for the right word, and Leela, Harry, and Caleb all look at me, alert, because they know who Don is and what he does. They always think I know more than I do, which is next to nothing. Whatever I say now will make it sound as though things have escalated, as though a war being fought on the other side of the world is not quite so far away.
I'm sure they just want to be prepared for every eventuality. It sounds like something Don would say, and as I think of him, flicking my eyes towards Yarrick, I'm surprised that I don't feel even a flutter of guilt.
It does scare me, says Leela. I feel like things are getting closer to home now. There could even be drones out there now, scanning our houses, our schools, our hospitals.
Her voice wavers, and I'd like to hug her, but I still feel wrapped in Yarrick's scent, as if our kiss is visible on my skin if you look closely enough.
No, Yarrick shakes his head. No, that won't happen. You'll all see out this war in safety. This country, our people, we're much stronger than we give ourselves credit for.
His voice is little more than a murmur, and yet he commands the room. For the first time, even Maya stops talking to look at him. An expression approximating respect crosses Caleb's face. My lips part, and something wells up inside me that I can barely acknowledge. Several minutes pass before we each receive the same message on our eye lenses. Drill complete. Thank you for your cooperation.
Well, thank goodness for that,
Maya drawls as she gets to her feet and thoroughly dusts herself off before helping up the couple she's been talking to.
Everyone starts to file out, eager to leave. Leela pauses at the door and asks me to turn the lamps out before following the others up the stairs. I glance back into the room, and Yarrick is still pulling himself upright from the floor. He loses his balance and stumbles to the left. He places the flat of his hand against the wall to steady himself.
The vision in my left eye is going, he says, by way of explanation.
The tumour, I think, is sitting somewhere in there to the right of his skull, causing problems on his left. The brain works with opposites, killing him in mirror image. I'm sorry, I say, but it's not what I mean. I sound like I feel bad for him, but I don't. What impresses me is that he looks anything but weak. Tautness of his jaw is unapologetic, and his body is still strong beneath the red t-shirt that clings to his frame. It's almost easy to convince myself that the diagnosis could be wrong. He could have months, perhaps years. Come on.
I'm still holding the heavy door open a fraction, waiting.
The lights.
He turns one off, and then the other. I can just about see him walking back towards me, but as I pull on the handle, his hand closes over mine. He pushes the door shut, and the room is plunged into darkness. I clench my jaw and blink into the splotches of colour as my eyes adjust. He leans into me, and I sink back against the wall. Yarrick, we can't, I say, without meaning it. I'll wonder where we are.
He remains silent, and kisses fall upon my neck as his fingers move to my shirt buttons. I manage to stifle the strange noise that bubbles up in my throat by pressing my lips together. I find my teeth closing around his earlobe.
This is crazy, I whisper into his ear. We can't do this.
Why not?
He asks me, and I feel him pull away. I have an answer. I do. I have a list of answers. But it's so long that my brain can't process it, and already my body is yearning for him to press against me again. For a split second it crosses my mind that he knows exactly what he is doing. It's a thought which almost illuminates the room. And then we are invisible to each other again. I rise onto my tiptoes and move my hands to the back of his neck, my thumbs tracing his jawline. I pull him towards me as I kiss him.
The heat of his breath melts the boundaries between us as I swivel him around and push him up against the wall. The force with which I move surprises me.
His lips change shape, and I know that he is smiling.
I'll tell you what's crazy,
he whispers as one hand slips inside my shirt and he runs his fingers down the bone of my basque. The other hand moves to the clasp of my trousers.
It's crazy that I'm about to die, and I'm feeling like this for the first time in my life.
I don't know how much time passes. After just a few moments, it fails to matter. It crosses my mind that the timelessness of our encounter is ironic, given that we've already discussed the concept today. Heaven will be like this. It will be without time, just a constant rolling of bliss, punctuated by subtle reminders that things are not always so perfect. At the end, I fuss over myself in the darkness, pressing the backs of my hands against the fire of my cheeks, combing my fingers through my hair and retying it. I can feel the shock beginning to register, starting in my stomach and rippling outward. We arrange our clothes in silence. I feel the weight of dust and dirt upon them, and I brush vigorously at the material.
I only realize my hands are shaking when I go to fasten my belt.
A fingertip glides down the side of my face. I look at the door. I don't want to go beyond it.
I can't bring myself to put my fingers upon the handle. I don't want to be the one to break the spell. Already so little time is left for us.
If you don't open this door, I never will,
he whispers.
I turn the handle and pull it towards me. Yarrick tries to hold it, but the door's weight leans on to his left side, and I feel him stumble behind me, losing his balance and resting his hand upon my shoulder to steady himself.
You okay? I ask, turning around.
He shrugs, embarrassed.
I touch my own cheeks, soaking up the heat I find there, and trying to wish it away before anyone else sees it. I walk up the spiral staircase with my hand running up the rail, Yarrick's thumb resting upon it. I'm smiling at my feet, smiling like a teenager. The light gets brighter as we rise. As we turn the last corner before the top, I know before I look up that Leela is waiting for us.
She greets me with a stony stare. There's no pretense on her face. She has been there the whole time, waiting.
"Leela, look," I begin, hoping that I can placate her with my words, hoping that I can distract her for long enough that this all somehow fades into the background. Yarick stands behind me. I feel his hand slip beneath my jacket, and he lays his palm flat against the small of my back over my shirt. The heat that is on him is partly mine, and as it sinks back into me, I start to feel incredulous at what has just happened.
"Good day, Mr. Woods."
Leela ignores me. I sneak a glance up through my eyelashes at her face and see that the stern, thin lips of a moment ago are now forming a fake smile.
"We'll see you again soon. Isabel, could I see you in my office, please?"
Yarick and I look at each other, and I imagine all the things he could be trying to tell me with his eyes.
He can't say them now, but the unspoken words make him smoulder, and his weaker left eye flickers at the lid. He reaches out for me and squeezes my forearm before he turns away. Leela doesn't see the way his hand lingers, the pads of his fingers stroking tiny circles on the thin skin of my wrist. A weaker woman than me might melt.
"Leela," I sigh heavily. I know I can't be angry with her. She won't meet my eyes, but I follow her down the corridor. I look back once, and Yarick is watching us from the front door. He mouths something at me, but I can't decipher it from here. I can't blame him for that. I think about smiling and waving, but do neither before stepping into one of the side rooms. Leela closes the door behind me.
"Sit down," she demands. Her voice is low but furious.
Even though I stay standing in defiance, she sinks back into one of the chairs. I clench my teeth and look her in the face. It is etched with an anger that I didn't think her capable of.
"What in—"
She shakes her head in despair and rubs at her forehead as if she would like to erase me from her brain.
"I'll put this politely. What the hell are you thinking?"
I shrug as if I'm a child in detention. I wonder whether there's any chance I can explain my way out of this. If there is any excuse I can give or a lie I can tell to make it all go away.
"I know I joked about it on Friday night," she continues, "but you can't take advantage of a client like that. Or let him take advantage of you."
"Oh, for goodness sake, Leela. Nothing even happened." She raises her eyebrows and takes her time to run her eyes over me, looking for signs of the truth. I know she isn't stupid. She can see for herself without noticing my smudged mascara, my reddened lips. I sigh. I wouldn't allow anyone else to make me feel defeated. "You shouldn't have waited for us," I say.
"I stayed there because I was protecting you. Can't you see that?"
Her voice rises in volume with each word.
"I didn't want anyone else to realize. Now I'm thinking that maybe I should have knocked the fucking door down and pulled you both out of there."
Leela doesn't usually swear. She hates confrontation. I remember when she had to sack a receptionist, she cried for a week. I glimpse over my shoulder through the frosted glass of the door to check no one is out there listening. I've fallen for him. Leela sits back in her chair and presses the base of her palms against her temples.
"No, you haven't, Izzy. After such a short time, it's lust and you're being reckless."
"Don't be stupid." My veins fizz with the fear that she could keep us apart.
"I think I know the difference between love and lust, Leela.
She rolls her eyes and I look away.
How did he get into your head? Endless compliments, offering you reassurance about all of this?
She gestures vaguely to the space around us. A voice drops back to a whisper.
Regardless, you can't be his architect any longer, Izzy. You can't, and you won't. It would be wrong of me to let you. I'm reassigning him to Harry, and I don't expect you to have any further contact with each other. We're adults, Leela.
A fearful fury leaps into my chest, and I slam my hand down on the table.
He's dying, Isabel! She spits the words out. He's vulnerable!
She looks at me as if she cannot believe my stupidity. I briefly see it for myself, like I've stared at a bright light for too long, the ghost of it appearing with each blink of my eyes. She opens her mouth to speak again, pausing as she thinks through her words. It's probably going to be the same advice she's given me a dozen times.
If only you would think before you speak, Izzy. And you're vulnerable.
Her voice drops, and she pushes a hand across the table towards mine. That's where you're wrong, Leela. Can I go now? She spreads her palms in defeat, and I move towards the door.
How many more times am I going to have to look out for you? She asks. However many times it takes before you learn that you don't have to, I say.
And I slam the door behind me. Chapter 11. Time passes in a blur. Don comes home for a couple of nights at a time before leaving again. I can't bring myself to look at him, let alone touch him, and I bury myself in work. I don't eat, which is usually a sign that I'm happy. This surprises me, because happiness is not what I feel. The emotions tumble like laundry in my belly, clean and warm, but it feels as if they are too big for me to process. Leela signed me off for the rest of the week. I received a blunt message when I got home the night after the drill. Don't come in until Monday. I've never been the kind of person who spends all week longing for the weekend. I slept a lot, yet I still felt drained. I hated not being in the office. I don't even know what Leela told Caleb. I suppose she said that I was sick. I wonder what excuse she gave him for transferring my client like that. She must have sworn Harry to complete client-patient confidentiality. I don't know, because she still hasn't spoken to me herself. In the week since, I've been slinking into the office early before anyone else arrives, and, like tonight, leaving sharply. I manage to get out of the office even earlier than usual. The evenings are already drawing in. Soon I'll be leaving work to meet him in wintry darkness, if he is still here when the last leaves have fallen. When Yarrick suggested we meet at his family home when I was off work, it seemed wrong. I found myself suggesting a hotel instead.
I have to see you, he said. It doesn't matter where.
Now that I'm reflecting on it, I realize my choice is even seedier. Just once, I told myself, and then we should call time on what was happening between us. But it's September already. I feel like we must make the most of how long we have left with each other. I have an hour or so before I need to make my way to the hotel. As I peer at Yarrick's house across the street, I shift against the wall. Flakes from its crumbling surface slip under my collar and into my silk camisole. I don't expect to find him here. Right now, he'll still be in Harry's office, finalizing the details of the memories he wants to feature in his heaven. They will be starting the last stage of approval procedures and discussing the neurological process and its risks. Yarrick and I have tried not to talk about his sessions with Harry. I think he knows it would drive me crazy not being able to take control of his heaven. And I worry that Harry won't do a good enough job, although I'd never say that to Yarrick. I squint at an upper floor window, framed by heavy swag curtains. A bedroom. I picture a silhouette of us in a shadowy embrace behind the glass. It's still what you'd call an affair. There's still Don, and there's still a marriage, even if it's in tatters. Nor have I come looking for Sarah, I tell myself. Drawing comparisons is dangerous territory. Yet there is a woman's figure in the lounge, picking up toys from the floor. From here, I can see little more than a short, sharp bob and a pair of sunglasses hooked into a neckline. She disappears from view, and then the front door opens. She pauses on the path, as if glancing at the time, and then heads down the street. Before I know it, I'm crossing the road to follow her. My brain is yelling at me to stop and turn around, but my curiosity pads boldly onwards. Her dress swishes around her knees as she walks. I'm not close enough to tell for sure, but her long, pale calves suggest she is taller than me. She may even be the same height as Yarrick. I push back my shoulders and lift my chin to rival her as best I can. We walk for several streets, turning a few corners until we reach the parade of shops beside the tube station. By the time I catch up with her, she is standing in front of a florist's shop, talking to a woman in a polka dot apron. I stop a few feet away, staring at the funereal display of white carnations shaped into a heart, while I listen. My senses sharpen upon her. The post-work bustle fades into the periphery.
12 as usual, Sarah?
The woman asks her.
Let me guess, just the white and purple ones?
Sarah. Sarah Woods. Not the nanny or another relative. This is her. I swallow back the guilt that bubbles like lava at the back of my throat. I try to get a glimpse of her face, but I can only see her nose poking out from behind the bob of brown hair.
No, you don't need to count them, she says. Just a couple of bunches. They all look nice.
The woman gathers the flowers from the bucket and swings open the door into the shop before turning back to her.
Are you sure? I know how particular your husband is.
Those are fine, really.
Her words are clipped by irritation. I'm surprised. Yarrick seems so laid back. I find it hard to imagine he would care about a bunch of flowers. I grab the nearest bouquet and follow them inside. I'm close enough that Sarah holds the door open for me without looking around. She smells of Turkish delight. I stand at the back of the shop, casting my eyes over the rails of wrapping paper while the woman lays the anemones on the counter. I look down at the flowers, which I've cradled like a baby in the crook of my arm, pink peonies with pure white centres. They are blousy, their heads heavy with imprecise beauty. Something for a bride, really, not something to impose upon my minimalist flat. Mine and Don's flat, a voice inside my head reminds me. I watch as the woman lays the stems in the middle of the brown paper. Her hands hover over them and she lifts her head to look Sarah in the face, as if she is about to speak. Her eyes catch mine.
I won't be a moment, love,
she says, and she goes back to wrapping the blooms.
Oh, no rush, really, I say.
Sarah turns her head to look at me, smiling politely. And I notice for the first time that she's probably a few years younger than me, so 10 years younger than Yarrick.
Those are gorgeous, she says, pointing at the flowers in my arms and rotating her whole body to face me. Peonies?
She speaks as delicately as her appearance would suggest. I nod.
I think so.
My tongue feels too big for my mouth. Part of me wants to drop to my knees and beg forgiveness, but then I remind myself that their marriage was already failing before I came along. It's not my fault, just like it's not my fault that he's dying. For the first time, I look straight at her head on. She's all hips and bosom in her jersey dress, and she twiddles her hands together awkwardly over her stomach. I bet she was the girl at school that got teased for having to wear a bra at the age of 11. I think of my petite, boyish frame, my narrow hips and the gentle swell of my chest, my tight, sharp lips and chin. Sarah turns back to the woman.
"I'm so sorry. Can I take a bunch of those instead, please?" she asks, pointing to my bunch.
Yes, of course.
The woman doesn't seem to mind, pushing the anemones to the side of the counter.
"Let me just go and grab some."
"You can have these," I say, stepping forward and handing them to Sarah. She takes them, her lips parting in surprise. "As lovely as they are, I was just thinking I was going to get something else instead."
"Oh, okay. Thank you."
Sarah hands the flowers to the woman before turning back to face me.
"Look at us, hey? Buying our own flowers."
The woman tears a new sheet of brown paper from the roll and starts to wrap the peonies. The rustling almost drowns out Sarah's voice.
"Yeah," I say with a shrug, returning her smile. "That's a good sign," the woman behind the counter says, her eyes wide, conspiratorial. "It means your men haven't done anything they need to apologize for."
We both laugh.
"Oh, yes, my husband was always in here, wasn't he?"
Sarah jokes, her voice high. But I note the use of the past tense, and, like me, the woman looks a little too long at Sarah's face. Perhaps she's embarrassed at her earlier mention of him. The meaning of her words is clear, and it hangs like dirty laundry in the air between us.
"Well, I'm apologizing to myself," I say, blurting out the words to break the tension and avoid thinking too much about what she might mean. The woman laughs, and Sarah raises her eyebrows as if to agree, as if to admit that she's also done wrong. She pays for the peonies and leaves, granting me a quick, shy smile as she walks past to the door.
"Can I take these?"
I ask the lady, as I take Sarah's place at the counter, laying my hand over the discarded anemones. She squints when she looks at me, and then nods in the direction of the closing door.
"Such a shame, that,"
she says. "I used to see him in here a lot.
Handsome chap. He nearly bought up the whole shop one day. A real romantic, you know."
I bristle with envy and pride. "He's mine now," I want to tell her.
"Anything else, love?" she asks.
"No, that's all. Thank you."
I lean forward to present my chip to the payment receiver. The buzz of acceptance in my neck matches my excitement. It's time to meet Yarrick. Outside, I flag down an autocab and jump inside, breathlessly issuing directions. I can't get there fast enough, but it's as if the heat from my body is sinking through the car, making its tires stick to the asphalt. Finally, we pull up outside the hotel, and I push the mirage of dawn to the back of my mind. This is another world, a crazy, temporary world that can only last so long. As long as Yarrick lives. I reach for the anemones as I'm getting out, but then hesitate. What if Yarrick does only like the white and purple ones, six of each? I give them one last glance and leave them wilting on the hot leather seat. I hear the door unlock as I lean into it, and I knock before letting myself in. By design, I've never arrived first. It's my way of holding something back, I suppose. Just one of the many self-deluding ways I'm making it look as if I'm being dragged into this affair, rather than pulling it closer to my heart with every breath. I sigh at the empty room. By arriving on time, I've let my guard fall another notch lower. I slip off my heels, place them side by side at the foot of the bed, and run a fingertip over the wooden frame. It comes back clean. I like this place because it's always immaculate. Deciding to take a shower before Yarrick arrives, I take off my clothes and hang them up in the wardrobe. There's a mirror inside the door. I stand on my tiptoes, push back my shoulders, and try to find the angle at which I look most shapely. Giving up, I shake out my hair and pull it over my shoulders. It's getting long. Bathroom lights on. They only murmur and they fade up. Shower on. The shower is instantly hot, and I stand right beneath the head. I press my hands against the back wall above the controls and stretch out my shoulders. The tension is somewhat eased by the water, but it still tingles at my neck and down my spine. I know what's causing it. Guilt. Murky guilt, filling up the gaps between the bones like mucus. I push the thought away and fill my hands with shampoo. I massage my scalp and twist my hair into a rope around my neck. I turn back around and flush the suds from my eyes before opening them. A dark shape. A face. A man. Adrenaline explodes behind my ribs and my scream must echo down the corridor. Yarrick creases up with laughter. Enough that he stumbles and has to lean his forearms on the vanity. You bastard! I cry. He shakes his head by way of apology and wipes his eyes. He looks me up and down before returning his eyes to mine through the glass of the shower screen. They narrow and the bright wall lights glitter in his pupils. My breath starts to calm, but speeds up again as, without speaking, he takes off his clothes and kicks them aside, pulling open the shower door and stepping inside with me. The steam fills my lungs as he wraps his arms around me. His muscles are softening. They don't hold me in a clamp like they did at first. Instead, we meld together like plasticine, slipping into each other's negative space. He kisses my lips, my face, my neck. The warm water works its way into my mouth, and it softens the sharp ends of his stubble. The tension in my shoulders is forgotten. He runs his nose down my body and kisses my belly. I hold on to his left arm because I know by now that he needs me to help him balance. So much of what we do together is this mutually understood, unspoken language. It's why it feels right. Yarrick kneels before me, and the water parts his hair where it is thinnest from his treatment. I lay my palms on his skull and trace the lines of the scars with my fingertips. Some are old, faded and pink. The newest line, his last lost hope, remains defiant. Raised and purple. Afterwards, I help Yarrick to the bed, and he stretches out on his back. I sit down, facing away from him, so I don't have to look at the water soaking into the bedspread from his towel.
You like it here?
Yarrick asks. I hum approval and curl my bare toes into the plush carpet. The room is modern, with clean lines. He knows my taste.
I've booked in for a few days this time, he says. I haven't got any more appointments for a while now, and I need some space.
But what if you feel ill? You'll be on your own.
I thought maybe you could stay too.
I curl one knee up onto the bed and twist around to face him. A fantasy bursts onto the stage of my imagination. We order room service. We don't get dressed. We take baths together each morning. The idea is tempting. I feel as though we are locked away from the world in here. If staying in this room would stop anyone from finding us, then maybe it could stop death, too. I can't, I say, shaking my head and letting the wet strands of hair cling to my cheeks. Yarrick clambers across the bed on his stomach and smooths them back behind my ears.
You could, he says. You're just choosing not to.
Don's shadow has slunk under the door. I tighten the towel around my chest. I just don't want to think about him.
Yarrick frowns as if he can read my thoughts.
Will you stay with him after I've gone?
Yarrick, don't. While I'm sitting in this room, Don doesn't exist, and Yarrick isn't dying. Being with him is living in the moment, freely, joyfully. I do not make considerations, plans, judgments. I live and breathe him. And when I leave, our time together is like a daydream. But I must face reality. I know that. I must tell Don that things are over between us. But I'm more of a coward than I ever imagined. It's so much easier not to.
Yarrick doesn't push me to answer, but lets his towel fall to the floor and climbs awkwardly under the duvet. I arrange the pillows behind him, supporting his left side with an extra cushion. He winces and groans a little as his head bounces against the bedstead.
Oh, sorry, I say, kissing his forehead.
My consultant gave me some new painkillers, but they're not really scratching the surface, he says, rubbing his temples. I'm after Oblivion strength ones.
He chuckles under his breath.
Do you think yours would do?
The hint is heavy, and yet I'm able to push it away, like I do the jealousy, the guilt, the confusion.
Meanwhile, he watches me, his expression unreadable. I think of Sarah's kind face and her words. My husband was always in here, wasn't he?
How are things with you and your wife, Yarrick?
My voice is oddly constricted. As I speak, I realize the question makes me sound as though I'm his architect again.
Yarrick flicks his eyes at me and beckons for me to curl up against his chest.
I snuggle into his damp skin and rest my cheek against the hollow beneath his collarbone.
I inhale the natural scent that's starting to come back through his pores.
He's quiet for several seconds.
Surely we don't have to talk about her?
He sounds as if he's talking to one of his children. I just keep thinking...
I can't finish the sentence because there's no way of explaining what goes through my head. Is this really an affair? Does she still love him? What if it's just his illness pushing them apart?
How long have you known her for? I ask, eventually. It seems a simple place to start.
We've been together for 8 years, married for 5.
I note that he's using the present tense, and it's enough to make me slide my hand from his bare hip. Really? So, she must have been... Sarah's soft face appears in my mind as I count backwards, working out how old I think she might have been.
Surely not a teenager.
As my eyes do their sums on the wall, I notice Yarrick looking at me strangely. Of course. I've slipped up. I'm not supposed to know anything about her.
But if there was a question, it fades quickly from his face, and he kisses me on the tip of my nose.
As his lips move on to mine, I'm almost distracted, but there's so much more I need to know. I pull my head back. What's she like?
She's womanly, she's beautiful,
I know that. Garrick tuts and closes his eyes, but the smile stays on his face. He knows there is no right answer.
Is she very different from me?
Utterly, he whispers. Delight sparkles in his eyes as he runs his thumb down my spine. I roll my eyes playfully, and the questions finally leave my mind as his lips meet mine.
Is?
I swallow the groan as he bites at my ear. Yes.
I can't die without you.
He pulls back from me to study my face. He squeezes my hand, and I can only stare back open-mouthed. I've always wondered how this would feel. 4 years with Don, and we've never discussed it. We never will.
I'm in love with you. You must know that by now, he says.
I feel the breath leave my lungs, and wonder how I have been cheated out of meeting this man until this point in my life. The connection I feel to him casts the rest of it into the background, a fuzzy backdrop. This is real.
I know, I say.
The words come out as the lightest of whispers.
I love you too.
I want you in my heaven,
he adds, in case I haven't understood his meaning. But of course I have. I understand everything he says before he has even said it.
And I want you in mine, too, when the time comes.
So, you'll send me the official documents to sign?
He asks. I nod, and he pulls me back into him. I bury my face in his neck, and we hug tightly.
Chapter 12. The following Friday, there's a staff meeting that I want to avoid. I excuse myself on the flimsy basis of an urgent appointment at the neurology labs. I haul myself out of bed a little later than usual, do a yoga session in the living room, and make my way to the Francis Crick Institute in St. Pancras. Jess has been pressing me to visit for months now, so I'm killing two birds with one stone.
So, do you want to see Claire's simulations?
She asks me. I nod as I try to summon my usual enthusiasm for talking about work. My mind is full of Yarrick.
Are you all right, Isabel?
She says in her soothing Irish lilt.
You're in another world today.
Jess always treats me like an old friend, even though we've only met a handful of times over the years. I'm envious of her openness and her natural warmth.
Yeah, I'm fine. I am just, you know, a bit under the weather.
I flap my fingers around my throat region, but I suspect that my acting is unconvincing.
Well, I can tell that's not the entire truth, but I'll let you off,
she says, winking at me. I notice the dart of her eyes towards my stomach, and I realize with a twist of embarrassment that she is wondering whether I'm pregnant. Oh, God. I'm wearing a loose top, so she wouldn't have noticed the beginnings of a bump anyway. But what if I was? I find myself thinking, I wouldn't know it yet. And if I was pregnant, it would be Yarrick's baby. I'd be carrying the baby of a dying man. A man I've fallen for.
Jess leads me across the corridor to the other side of the building. We enter the lab through a wide set of automatic doors, and as they slide open to let us in, my eyes drift to the inscription in the architrave above us, Nos sunt electrica.
We are electric,
Jess calls back to me without turning around. She must have heard me pause in the entrance. Perhaps everybody looks at it and stops to work out what it means, like I just did. I find myself smiling as I quicken my pace to catch up with Jess's fast footsteps and the animated bounce of her curls. We are electric. The idea that we're all nothing more than a wet computer has always seemed magical to me. To others, it is depressing. To those of an older way of thinking, the people who still grasp on to the idea of a god, it is almost heretical.
But to know that everything we are, every thought, emotion, memory, is no more than the arrangement of electrical activity in our brains, with a dash of chemical trickery here and there, never fails to inspire me. Evolution is a wonderful thing. Give me a few billion years, I used to think, and just see what I could do. Jess stands in the middle of the large, dark room, waiting for me. The only light emanates from the pedestal in the center of the black tiled floor, from which digital projections shimmer in a column of mist. I feel acutely aware of how far we are underground, inside a sealed chamber of dead people's memories. I walk to stand beside Jess and watch as she manipulates the data through the mist. The display hisses in the hush of the room. I can't believe I've never been down here.
Don't give me that is, she replies. I've invited you enough times.
She speaks without looking away from her projections. Her eyes are narrowed in concentration. She sorts through them, flicking from one to another, before selecting one square of light and enlarging it in front of her by pulling her hands apart.
You might want to start spending more time here, she adds. It's fireproof, bombproof, the works. Backup power and life support if you need it, too.
I look up at the ceiling, trying to imagine what reinforces it. I guess it has to be.
So this room is where we find the basic details for each patient, Jess explains. Anyone authorized to enter the electric lab can see where Claire's simulations are stored, room 23, but they can't then enter unless...
The mist flashes with a green light, and at the same time, I hear a click. Looking around, I realize that the walls of this circular room are lined with doors, and one of them has just unlocked.
Unless they're me,
Jess whispers, and rests her hand on my shoulder to guide me in the direction of the unlocked door.
What kind of biometrics does that system use? I ask.
A mixture. Voice recognition, iris recognition, blood vessel patterns. I think it studies my biochemical fingerprint, too, as I use it. It's pretty advanced.
Jess pushes open the black door, and we move into a more brightly lit room. It's small, though, a few meters square. It is the opposite of the central room we have just left, in that nothing is in the middle. Instead, everything is around the edge. A smooth, sloped panel runs at waist height from either side of the door, all around the walls. I fold my arms across my chest, feeling a bit claustrophobic.
I'll try not to touch anything I shouldn't, I joke. You could lie across it naked is and it wouldn't do anything. You're dead to this machine.
It's not a pleasant thought to be so powerless. I find myself running my fingertips over the featureless black panel in the hope that Jess is wrong, and that maybe I can rouse something into life. Nothing happens. I think of the cemetery that my sister and I used to play in when we were kids. We used to run amongst the gravestones, ducking and hiding from each other, screaming with laughter. We were told off several times by mourners, and once by the vicar himself. But we were too young to understand what loss meant. The stones were ancient relics to us, not living memories for the visitors who wandered between them. I don't think we even got as far as realizing that dead bodies were buried in the ground beneath our feet. I become aware that Jess is muttering, either to herself or to the machine. She twirls her mass of brown hair back at the nape of her neck, letting the curls secure themselves to each other in a messy knot. The air smells so clean in here, almost completely without odour. I look around for vents, but see none. Jess moves a few paces to the other side of the room and lays her fingers on the sloping surface of the panel. She runs a fingertip in small circles, as if feeling for a hidden texture, and taps twice. A cartridge pops out and unfurls into a small platform the size of a fingernail.
That's it,
announces Jess.
What?
The only living part of the whole setup.
I peer closer, bending over the tiny platform.